her own father, as if that must be surely whom they meant. She had to do a little leap in her mind to a hotel room and a downlight. Well, Mrs. Lippman, is this relevant? All I know about Ziggy's father is that he was keen on erotic asphyxiation and humiliating women. He appeared to be charming and kind. He could sing Mary Poppins songs. I thought he was delightful. In fact, you'd probably think he was delightful too. And yet, he was not who he appeared to be at all. I guess you could describe him as a bully. So that may be relevant. Also, just to give you the whole picture, there is the possibility that Ziggy is actually my dead grandfather, reincarnated. And Poppy was a very gentle soul. So I guess it depends on whether you believe in a hereditary tendency towards violence or reincarnation. I can't think of anything relevant, said Jane. He has a lot of male role models. Oh, yes, yes, I'm sure he does, said Mrs. Lippman. Goodness, some children here have fathers who travel or work such long hours, they never see them at all. So I'm certainly not implying that Ziggy is missing out because he's growing up in a single-parent household. I'm just trying to get the whole picture. Have you asked him about this? Asked Jane. Her heart twisted at the thought of Ziggy's being questioned by the school principal without her there. He slept with a teddy bear. He sat on her lap and sucked his thumb when he got tired. It still seemed like a minor miracle to her that he could walk and talk and dress himself. And now here he was, living this whole other life separate from her, with big, grown-up, scary dramas taking place. I have, and he denies it quite emphatically. So without Amabella's corroboration, it really is very difficult to know where to go next. She was interrupted by a knock on the door of her office. The school secretary put her head in. She shot a wary look at Jane. I thought I should let you know Mr. and Mrs. Klein are already here. Mrs. Lippman blanched. But they're not due for another hour. My board meeting was rescheduled, said a familiar, strident voice. Renata appeared at the secretary's shoulder, clearly ready to barge on in. So we just wondered if you could fit us in. She caught sight of Jane, and her face hardened. Oh, I see. Mrs. Lippman shot Jane an anguished look of apology. Jane knew from Madeline that Jeff and Renata regularly donated ostentatious sums of money to the school. At last year's school trivia night, we all had to sit there like grateful peasants while Mrs. Lippman thanked the Kleins for paying for the entire school to be air-conditioned, Madeline had told her. Then she'd brightened as a thought struck her. Maybe Celeste and Perry can take them on this year. They can all play I'm Richer Than You together. The school secretary wrung her hands. Mrs. Lippman made a point of having an open-door policy for school parents and was flexible about people dropping in without an appointment. The secretary had no experience with a situation like this. Is it possible you could come back another time? She said pleadingly to Renata. Not really, said Renata. Anyway, I assume we're all here to discuss the same topic, aren't we? Mrs. Lippman hurried out from behind her desk. Mrs. Klein, I really think it would be better. This is fortuitous, in fact. Renata strode past the secretary and straight into the office, followed by a pale, stocky, ginger-haired man in a suit and tie, who was presumably Jeff. Jane hadn't met him before. Most of the fathers were still strangers to her. Jane got to her feet and held her arms protectively across her body, her hands clutching at her clothes, as if they were about to be ripped off. The Kleins were about to expose her and lay her ugly, shameful secrets bare for all the other parents to see. Ziggy wasn't the result of nice, normal, loving sex. He was the result of the shameful actions of a young, silly, fat, ugly girl. Ziggy was not right, and he was not right because Jane had let that man be his father. She knew it was illogical because Ziggy wouldn't otherwise exist, but it felt logical because Ziggy was always going to be her son. Of course he was. How could she not be his mother? But he was meant to be born later, when Jane had found him a proper daddy and a proper life. If she'd done everything properly, he wouldn't be marked by this terrible genetic stain. He wouldn't be behaving this way. She thought of the first time she'd seen him. He was so upset to be born, screaming with his whole body, tiny limbs flailing, as if he were falling, and her first thought was, "I'm so sorry, little baby. I'm so sorry for putting you through this." The exquisitely painful feeling that flooded her body reminded her of grief, even though she would have called it joy. It felt the same. She had thought the raging torrent of her love for this funny-looking little red-faced creature would surely wash away the dirty little memory of that night. But the memory stayed, clinging to the walls of her mind like a slimy black leech. "You need to get that son of yours under control." Renata stepped directly in front of Jane. Her finger stabbed at the air near Jane's chest. Her eyes were bloodshot behind her glasses. Her anger was so palpable and righteous in the face of Jane's doubts. "Renata," remonstrated Jeff. He held out a hand to Jane. "Jeff Klein, please excuse Renata. She's very upset." Jane shook his hand. "Jane Chapman."
All right, well, perhaps then, if we are all here together, perhaps we could have a constructive chat," said Mrs. Lipman, with a tinkle of nerves in her cut-glass voice. "Can I offer anyone tea or coffee? Water?"
"I don't want refreshments," said Renata.
Jane saw with something like sick fascination that Renata's entire body was trembling. She looked away. Seeing the evidence of Renata's raw emotions was like seeing her naked.
"Renata!"
Jeff held his arm diagonally across his wife's body, as if she were about to step in front of a car.
"I'll tell you what I want," said Renata to Mrs. Lipman. "I want her child to stay the hell away from my daughter."
Chapter 37. Madeline pulled open the sliding door from the backyard and saw Abigail sitting on the couch, looking at something on her laptop.
"Hey there," she said, and winced at the fake cheer in her voice. She couldn't speak naturally to her own daughter now. Now that Abigail only came on weekends, it felt like Madeline was the host and Abigail was an important guest. She felt like she had to offer her drinks and check on her comfort. It was ridiculous. Whenever Madeline caught herself behaving this way, she got so angry she went too far the other way and briskly demanded that Abigail perform some domestic chore, like hanging out a basket of washing. The worst part was that Abigail behaved exactly like the good-mannered guest that Madeline had brought her up to be and picked up the laundry basket without comment, and then Madeline was guilty and confused. How could she ask Abigail to hang out washing when Abigail didn't bring any washing home with her? It was like asking your guest to hang out your laundry. So then she'd rush out to help put the clothes on the line and make stilted chit-chat while all the words she couldn't say poured through her head. "Just come back home, Abigail. Come back home and stop this,"
He left us. He left you. You were my reward. Missing out on you was his punishment. How could you choose him?
What you doing?
Madeline plonked herself on the couch next to Abigail and peered at the laptop screen.
Is that America's Next Top Model?
She didn't know how to be around Abigail anymore. It reminded her of trying to be friends with an ex-boyfriend. That studied casualness of your interactions. The fragility of your feelings. The awareness that the little quirks of your personality were no longer so adorable. They might even be just plain annoying. Madeline had always played up to her role in the family as the comically crazy mother. She got overly excited and overly angry about things. When the children wouldn't do as they were told, she huffed and she puffed. She sang silly songs while she stood at the pantry door.
Where, oh, where are the tinned tomatoes? Tomatoes, wherefore art thou?
The kids and Ed loved making fun of her, teasing her about everything from her celebrity obsessions to her glittery eyeshadow. But now, when Abigail was visiting, Madeline felt like a parody of herself. She was determined not to pretend to be someone she wasn't. She was 40. It was too late to be changing her personality. But she kept seeing herself through Abigail's eyes and assuming that she was being compared unfavorably to Bonnie. Because she'd chosen Bonnie, hadn't she? Bonnie was the mother Abigail would prefer. It actually had nothing to do with Nathan. The mother set the tone of the household. Every secret fear that Madeline had ever had about her own flaws, she was obviously too quick to anger, often too quick to judge, overly interested in clothes, spent far too much money on shoes, thought she was cute and funny when perhaps she was just annoying and tacky, was now at the forefront of her mind. Grow up, she told herself. Don't take this so personally. Your daughter still loves you. She's just chosen to live with her father. It's no big deal. But every interaction with Abigail was a constant battle between this is who I am, Abigail, take it or leave it, and be better, Madeline. Be calmer, be kinder, be more like Bonnie.
Did you see Eloise get kicked off last week? Asked Madeline. This is what she would normally say to Abigail, so this is what she said.
I'm not looking at America's Next Top Model, sighed Abigail. I'm looking at Amnesty International. I'm reading about the violation of human rights.
Oh, said Madeline. Goodness.
Bonnie and her mum are both members of Amnesty International, said Abigail.
Of course they are, murmured Madeline.
This must be how Jennifer Aniston feels, thought Madeline, whenever she hears about Angelina and Brad adopting another orphan or two.
What?
That's great, said Madeline. I think Ed is too. We give a donation each year.
Oh, God, listen to yourself. Stop competing.
Was it even true? Ed might have let his membership lapse. She and Ed did their best to be good people. She bought raffle tickets for charity, gave money to street performers, and was always sponsoring annoying friends who were running yet another marathon for some worthy cause, even though the true cause was their own fitness. When the kids were older, she assumed she would do some sort of volunteer work like her own mother did. That was enough, wasn't it? For a busy working mother? How dare Bonnie make her question every choice she made? According to Abigail, Bonnie had recently decided she wasn't having any more children. Madeline didn't ask why, although she wanted to know,
and so she donated Skye's pram, stroller, cot, change table and baby clothes to a battered women's shelter.
"Isn't that amazing, Mum?" Abigail had sighed. "Other people would just sell that stuff."
Madeline had recently sold Chloe's old baby dresses on eBay. Then she'd gleefully spent the money on a new pair of half-price designer boots.
"So, what are you reading about?"
Was it good for a 14-year-old girl to be learning about the atrocities of the world? It was probably wonderful for her. Bonnie was giving Abigail a social conscience, while Madeline was just encouraging poor body image. She thought about what poor Jane said about society being obsessed with beauty. She imagined Abigail going into a hotel room with a strange man and him treating her the way that man had treated Jane. Rage ballooned. She imagined grabbing him by the hair on the back of his head and smashing his face over and over against some sort of concrete surface until it was a bloody, pulpy mess. Good God. She watched too much violent TV.
"What are you reading about, Abigail?"
she said again, and hated the irritable edge in her voice.
Did she have PMS again?
No, it wasn't the right time. She couldn't even blame that. She was just permanently bad-tempered these days. Abigail sighed. She didn't lift her eyes from the screen. "Child marriage and sex slavery," she said.
"That's awful," said Madeline.
She paused.
"Maybe don't..."
She stopped. She wanted to say something like, "Don't let it upset you," which was a terrible thing to say, which was just the sort of thing a privileged, frivolous, white Western woman would say. A woman who took far too much genuine pleasure in a new pair of shoes or a bottle of perfume. What would Bonnie say?
"Let us meditate on this together, Abigail. Om."
See, there was her superficiality again, making fun of meditation. How did meditating hurt anyone?
"They should be playing with dolls," said Abigail. Her voice was thick with angry teariness. "Instead, they're working in brothels."
"You should be playing with dolls," thought Madeline, "or at least playing with makeup." She felt a surge of righteous anger with Nathan and Bonnie, because actually Abigail was too young and sensitive to know about human trafficking. Her feelings were too fierce and uncontrolled. She had inherited Madeline's unfortunate talent for instant outrage, but her heart was far softer than Madeline's had ever been. She had too much empathy, although, of course, all that excessive empathy was never directed at Madeline, or Ed, or Chloe and Fred. Madeline remembered when Abigail was only about 5 or 6, and so proud of her new ability to read. She'd found her sitting at the kitchen table, her lips moving as she carefully sounded out a headline on the front page of a newspaper, with an expression of pure horror and disbelief. Madeline couldn't remember now what the article was about. Murder? Death? Disaster? No, actually she did remember. It was a story about a child taken from her bed in the early 80s. Her body was never found. Abigail still believed in Santa Claus at that time. "It's not true," Madeline had told her quickly, snatching up the paper and vowing never to leave it anywhere accessible ever again. "It's all made up." Nathan didn't know about that, because Nathan wasn't there. Chloe and Fred were such different creatures, so much more resilient. Her darling little tech-savvy, consumerist savages. "I'm going to do something about this," said Abigail, scrolling down the screen.
Really? Said Madeline.
Well, you're not going to Pakistan, if that's what you're thinking. You're staying right here and watching America's Next Top Model, young lady.
What do you mean? A letter?
She brightened. She had a marketing degree. She could write a better letter than Bonnie ever could.
I could help you write a letter to our MP, petitioning for an...
No, interrupted Abigail scornfully. That achieves nothing. I've got an idea.
What sort of idea? Asked Madeline.
Afterward, she would wonder if Abigail might have answered her truthfully, if she could have put a stop to the madness before it even began. But there was a knock on the front door just then, and Abigail snapped shut the laptop.
That's Dad, she said, getting to her feet.
But it's only 4 o'clock, protested Madeline. She stood up too.
I thought I was driving you back at 5.
We're going to Bonnie's mother's for dinner, said Abigail.
Bonnie's mother, repeated Madeline.
Don't make a drama of it, Mum.
I didn't say a word. I didn't say, for example, that you haven't seen my mother in weeks.
Grandma is too busy with her social life to even notice, Abigail said accurately.
Abigail's dad is here, yelled Fred from the front of the house, meaning Abigail's dad's car is here.
G'day, mate, Madeline heard Nathan say to Fred.
Sometimes just the sound of Nathan's voice could evoke a wave of visceral memory. Betrayal, resentment, rage and confusion. He just left. He just walked out and left us, Abigail. And I couldn't believe it. I just could not believe it. And that night you cried and cried, that endless new baby cry that...
Bye, Mum, said Abigail. And she leaned down to kiss her compassionately on the cheek, as if Madeline were an elderly aunt she'd been visiting. And now, phew, it was time to get out of this musty place and go back home.
Chapter 38. Stew.
I'll tell you something I do remember. I ran into Celeste White once. I was on the other side of Sydney doing a job, and I had to go pick up some new taps because someone had stuffed up. Anyhow, long story short, I'm walking through a Harvey Norman store where they had all the bedroom furniture on display, and there's Celeste White lying flat on her back in the middle of a double bed staring at the ceiling. I did a double take and then said, "Hello, love," and she jumped out of her skin. It was like I'd caught her robbing a bank. It just seemed strange. Why was she lying on a discount double bed so far from home? Gorgeous looking woman. Stunning. But always a bit skittish, you know? Sad to think about it now. Very sad.
Are you the new tenant?
Celeste jumped and nearly dropped the lamp she was carrying.
Sorry, I didn't mean to startle you, said a plumpish, 40-ish woman in gym gear, emerging from the apartment across the corridor. She was accompanied by 2 little girls, who looked like they were twins, about the same age as Josh and Max.
I'm sort of the new tenant, said Celeste. I mean, yes, I am. I'm not sure exactly when we're moving in. It might be a while.
This hadn't been part of the plan. Talking to people. That was much too real. This whole thing was hypothetical. It would probably never actually come to be. She was just toying with the idea of a new life. She was doing it to impress Susie.
She wanted to go back to her next appointment with her plan all in place. Most women probably had to be nudged along for months. Most women probably came back to their next appointment having done nothing. Not Celeste. She always did her homework.
"I've taken a 6-month lease on a flat," she planned to tell Susie, casually, briskly, in McMahon's Point. "I could walk into North Sydney. I've got a friend who is a partner at a small law firm in North Sydney. She offered me a job about a year ago and I turned it down, but I'm sure she could still find me something. Anyway, if that didn't work out, I could get a job in the city. It's just a short ferry ride."
"Wow," Susie would say. She'd raise her eyebrows. "Good job."
Top of the class for Celeste. What a good girl. What a well-behaved, battered wife.
"I'm Rose," said the woman, "and this is Isabella and Daniela."
Was she serious? She called her children Isabella and Daniela? The girl smiled politely at her. One of them even said hello. Definitely twins with far better manners than Celeste's boys.
"I'm Celeste. Nice to meet you."
Celeste turned the key as fast as she could. "I'd better..."
"Do you have kids?"
said Rose hopefully, and the little girls looked at her hopefully.
"Two boys," said Celeste.
If she mentioned that she had twin boys, the amazing coincidence would create at least 5 more minutes of conversation she couldn't bear. She pushed open the door with her shoulder.
"Let me know if you need anything," said Rose.
"Thanks. See you soon." Celeste let the door go, and the two little girls began to squabble over whose turn it was to push the button for the elevator.
"Oh, for God's sake, girls, must we do this every single time?"
said their mother in what was obviously her normal voice, as opposed to the polite social voice she'd just used for Celeste. As soon as the door closed, there was complete silence, the mother's voice cut off in mid-sentence. The acoustics were good. There was a mirrored feature wall right next to the door that looked like it was left over from an ambitious decorating project in the 70s. The rest of the place was completely neutral. Blank white walls, hard-wearing grey carpet. Your quintessential rental property. Perry owned rental properties that were probably just like this. Theoretically, Celeste owned them too, but she didn't even know where they were. If they'd saved for an investment property together, just one, then she would have enjoyed that. She would have helped renovate it, picked out tiles, dealt with the real estate agent, said, "Oh, yes, of course," when the tenant asked for something to be fixed. That was the level of wealth where she would have felt comfortable. The unimaginable depths of Perry's money sometimes made her feel nauseated. She saw it on the faces of people when they saw her house for the first time, the way their eyes travelled across the wide expanses, the soaring ceilings, the beautiful rooms set up like little museum displays of wealthy family life. Each time she battled with equal parts pride and shame. She lived in a house where every single room silently screamed, "We have a lot of money, probably more than you." Those beautiful rooms were just like Perry's constant Facebook posts, stylized representations of their life. Yes, they did sometimes sit on that gloriously comfortable-looking couch and put glasses of champagne on that coffee table and watch the sun set over the ocean. Yes, they did. And sometimes, often, it was glorious. But that was also the couch where Perry had once held her face squashed into the corner and she'd thought she might die. And that Facebook photo captioned, "Fun day out with the kids," wasn't a lie, because it was a fun day out with the kids. And anyway, they didn't have a photo of what happened after the kids were in bed that night. Celeste's nose bled too easily. It always had. She carried the lamp into the main bedroom of the apartment. It was quite a small room. She'd get a double bed. She and Perry had a king-size bed, of course, but this room would be crammed even with a queen. She placed the lamp on the floor. It was a colourful, mushroom-shaped Art Deco lamp. She'd bought it because she loved it, and because it was a style Perry would hate. Not that he would have stopped her having it if she really wanted it, but he would have winced every time he looked at it. The way she would have winced at some of the gloomy-looking modern art pieces he pointed out in galleries. So he didn't buy them. Marriage was about compromise. "Honey, if you really like that girly antique look, I'll get you the real thing," he would have said tenderly. "This is just a cheap, tacky rip-off." When he said things like that, she heard, "You're cheap and tacky." She would take her time setting up this place with cheap, tacky things that she liked. She went to open one of the blinds to let in some light. She ran her fingertip along the slightly dusty windowsill. The place was pretty clean, but next time she'd bring some cleaning stuff and get it spick and span. Up until now, she had never been able to leave Perry because she couldn't imagine where she would go, how they would live. It was a mindset. It seemed impossible. This way, she would have an entire life set up, awaiting activation. She would have beds made up for the boys. She would have the fridge stocked. She would have toys and clothes in the cupboard. She wouldn't even need to pack a bag. She would have an enrollment form filled out for the local school. She would be ready. The next time Perry hit her, she wouldn't hit him back or cry or lie on her bed. She would say, "I'm leaving right now." She studied her knuckles. Or she'd leave when he was out of the country. Maybe that would be better. She would tell him on the phone. "You must know we couldn't go on like this," she said. "When you come back, we'll be gone." It was impossible to imagine his reaction. If she truly, actually left. If she ended the relationship, then the violence would stop too, because he would no longer have the right to hit her, just like he would no longer have the right to kiss her. Violence was a private part of their relationship, like sex. It would no longer be appropriate if she left him. She wouldn't belong to him in the same way. She'd get back his respect. Theirs would be an amicable relationship. He'd be a courteous but cold ex-husband. She knew already that the coldness would hurt her more than his fists ever had. He'd meet someone else. It would take him about 5 minutes. She left the main bedroom and walked down the tiny corridor to the room that would be for the boys. There was just enough room for 2 single beds side by side. She'd get them new quilt covers. Make it look nice. She was breathing hard, trying to imagine their baffled little faces. Oh, God, could she really do this to them? Susie thought that Perry would try to get sole custody of the children, but she didn't know Perry. His anger flared like a blowtorch and then died, unlike hers. Celeste was angrier than he was. She held grudges. Perry didn't hold grudges, but Celeste did. She was awful. She remembered it all. She remembered every single time, every single word. Susie had insisted that she begin documenting the abuse, as she called it. "Write everything down," she said. "Take photographs of your injuries.
Keep doctor's reports. It could be important in any court cases or custody hearings.
Sure, said Celeste, but she had no intention of doing so. How humiliating to see their behaviour written down. It would look like they were describing a children's fight.
I snapped at him. He yelled at me. I yelled back. He pushed me. I hit him. I got a bruise. He got a scratch.
He wouldn't try to take the children away from me, Celeste had told Susie. He'd do what was best for them.
He might think it was best for the children to stay with him, Susie told Celeste in her cool, matter-of-fact way.
Men like your husband often do go for custody. They have the resources, the money, the contacts. It's something you need to prepare for.
Your in-laws might get involved. Suddenly, everyone will have an opinion.
Her in-laws. Celeste felt a pulse of grief. She'd always loved being part of Perry's big, extended family. She loved the fact that there were so many of them. Random aunties, hordes of cousins, a trio of silver-haired, grumpy great-uncles. She loved the fact that Perry didn't even need a list when he went duty-free shopping for perfume. Chanel Coco Mademoiselle for Auntie Anita, Issey Miyake for Auntie Evelyn, he'd murmur to himself. She loved seeing Perry throw his arms around a favourite male cousin, tears in his eyes because they hadn't seen each other for so long. It seemed to prove something essentially good about her husband. Right from day one, Perry's family had warmly welcomed Celeste, as if they sensed that her own small, self-effacing family didn't quite stack up next to theirs, and that they could give her something she'd never had, besides money. Perry and family offered abundance in everything. When Celeste sat at the big, long table, eating Auntie Anita's spanakopita, watching Perry chat patiently with the grumpy great-uncles, while the twins ran wild with the other kids, a vision of Perry hitting her would flash into her head, and it would seem impossible, fantastical, absurd, even if it had happened the night before. And along with the disbelief would come shame, because she knew it must somehow be her fault, because this was a good, loving family, and she was the outsider. And imagine how appalled they would be to see her hitting and scratching their beloved Perry. No one in that big, laughing family would ever believe that Perry could be violent, and Celeste had no desire for them to know, because the Perry who bought perfumes for his aunties was not the Perry who lost his temper. Susie didn't know Perry. She knew examples and case studies and statistics. She didn't know that Perry's temper was only one part of him. It wasn't all of him. He wasn't just a man who hit his wife. He was a man who read bedtime stories to his children and put on funny voices, who spoke kindly to waitresses. Perry wasn't a villain. He was a man who just sometimes behaved very badly. Other women in this situation were afraid that their husbands would find them and kill them if they tried to leave. But Celeste was afraid she'd miss him. The pure pleasure of seeing the boys run to him when he returned from a trip, watching him drop his bags and get straight down on his knees, arms held wide. "I need to kiss Mummy now," he'd say. This was not simple. This was just a very strange marriage. She walked back through the apartment, ignoring the kitchen. It was small and pokey. She didn't want to think about cooking in that kitchen. The boys whining, "I'm hungry! Me too!" Instead, she went back into the main bedroom and plugged the lamp into the electrical outlet. The electricity was still on. The colours of the lamp turned rich and vibrant. She sat back and admired it. She loved her funny-looking lamp. After she moved in, she would have Jane and Madeline over to visit. She would show them her lamp, and they'd cram onto that tiny balcony and have afternoon tea. If she left Pirui, she'd miss her morning walks around the headland with Jane. For the most part, they'd walked in silence. It was like a shared meditation. If Madeline had walked with them, they would have all three talked the whole time, but it was a different dynamic when it was just Jane and Celeste. Recently, they'd both begun to tentatively open up. It was interesting how you could say things when you were walking that you might not otherwise have said with the pressure of eye contact across a table. Celeste thought of the morning when Jane had told her about Ziggy's biological father, the repulsive man who'd more or less raped her. She shuddered. At least sex with Perry had never been violent, even when it followed violence, even when it was part of their strange, intense game of making up, of forgiving and forgetting. It was always about love, and it was always very, very good. Before she met Perry, she had never felt as powerful an attraction to a man, and she knew she never would again. It wasn't possible. It was too specific to them. She would miss sex. She would miss living near the beach. She would miss coffee with Madeline. She would miss staying up late and watching DVD series with Perry. She would miss Perry's family. When you divorce someone, you divorce their whole family, Madeline had told her once. Madeline had been close to Nathan's older sister, but now they rarely saw each other. Celeste would have to give up Perry's family, as well as everything else. There was too much to miss, too much to sacrifice. Well, this was just an exercise. She didn't have to go through with any of it. It was all just a theoretical exercise to impress her counsellor, who probably wouldn't be all that impressed at all, because in the end, this was really just about money. Celeste wasn't showing any particular courage. She could afford to rent and furnish an apartment that she would probably never use, using money that her husband had earned. Most of Susie's clients probably had no access to money, whereas Celeste could withdraw large chunks of cash from different accounts without Perry even noticing. Or if he did, she could easily make up an excuse. She could tell him a friend needed cash, and he wouldn't blink. He'd offered to give more. It wasn't like those other men who kept their wives virtually imprisoned by restricting their movements, their access to money. Celeste was as free as a bird. She looked around the room. No built-in wardrobe. She'd have to buy a closet. How had she missed that at the inspection? The first time Madeline had seen Celeste's enormous walk-in wardrobe, her eyes had got shiny, as if she'd heard a piece of beautiful music or poetry. "This right here is my dream come true." Celeste's life was another person's dream come true. "No one deserves to live like this," Susie had said. But Susie hadn't seen the whole of their lives. She hadn't seen the expression on the boys' faces when Perry spun his crazy stories about early morning flights across the ocean. "You can't really fly, Daddy. Can he fly, Mummy? Can he?" She hadn't seen Perry rap dancing with his kids or slow dancing with Celeste on their balcony, the moon sitting low in the sky, shining on the sea as if it were there just for them. "It's almost worth it," she'd told Susie. Perhaps it was even fair. A little violence was a bargain price for a life that would otherwise be just too sickeningly, lavishly, moonlit perfect. So then, what the hell was she doing here? Secretly planning her escape route, like a prisoner. Chapter 39.
Ziggy, said Jane.
They were on the beach, building a sandcastle out of cold sand. The late afternoon sky hung low and heavy, and the wind whistled. It was mid-autumn, so tomorrow could easily be beautiful and sunny again, but today the beach was virtually deserted. Far in the distance, Jane could see someone walking a dog, and one lone surfer in a full-body wetsuit was walking toward the water, his board under his arm. The ocean was angry, chucking wave after wave, boom, on the beach. White water churned and bubbled as if it were boiling and spat up crazy fountains of spray into the air. Ziggy hummed as he worked on the sandcastle, patting it with a spade Jane's mother had bought him. "I saw Mrs. Lipman yesterday," she said, "and Amabella's mummy." Ziggy looked up. He was wearing a grey beanie pulled down over his ears and covering his hair. His cheeks were flushed with the cold. "Amabella says that someone in her class has been secretly hurting her when the teacher isn't looking," said Jane. "Pinching her. Even biting her." God, it was too awful to contemplate. No wonder Renata was out for blood. Ziggy didn't say anything. He put down the spade and picked up a plastic rake. "Amabella's mummy thinks it's you," said Jane. She nearly said, "It's not you, is it?" But she stopped herself. Instead, she said, "Is it you, Ziggy?" He ignored her. He kept his eyes on the sand, carefully raking straight lines. "Ziggy?" said Jane. He put down the rake and looked at her. His smooth little face was remote. His eyes looked off somewhere behind her head. "I don't want to talk about it," he said. Chapter 40. Samantha.
"Have you heard about the petition?" That's when I knew things were getting out of hand.
Harper. "I'm not ashamed to say that I started the petition. For heaven's sake, the school was doing nothing. Poor Renata was at her wit's end. You need to be able to send your child to school and know that she's in a safe environment."
Mrs. Lipman. "I most emphatically disagree. The school was not doing nothing. We had an extremely comprehensive plan of action. And let me be clear. We actually had no evidence that Ziggy was the one doing the bullying."
Thea. "I signed it. That poor little girl."
Jonathan. "Of course I didn't sign it. That poor little boy."
Gabrielle.
"Don't tell anyone, but I think I accidentally signed it. I thought it was the petition about getting the council to put in a pedestrian crossing on Park Street."
One week before the trivia night.
"Welcome to the inaugural meeting of the Piriwee Peninsula Erotic Book Club," said Madeline, as she opened her front door with a flourish. She'd already treated herself to half a glass of champagne. As she'd been preparing for tonight, she'd berated herself for starting a book club.
It was just a distraction from her grief over Abigail moving out. Was grief too dramatic a word? Probably. But that's how it felt. It felt like she'd suffered a loss. But no one was bringing her flowers, so she'd busied herself with a book club, of all things. Why didn't she just go shopping? She'd ostentatiously invited all the kindergarten parents, and 10 parents had said yes. Then she'd chosen a juicy, rollicking book she knew she'd enjoy and given everyone heaps of time to read it before realizing that everyone would have a turn choosing a book, and so she'd probably end up having to wade through some awful worthy tomes. Oh well, she had plenty of experience not doing her homework. She'd wing it on those nights. Or she'd cheat and ask Celeste for a summary. "Stop calling it the Erotic Fiction Club," said her first guest, Samantha, as she handed over a plate of brownies. "People are starting to talk. Carol is obsessed." Samantha was small and wiry, a pocket-sized version of an athlete. She ran marathons, but Madeline forgave her for this flaw because Samantha seemed to say exactly what she thought. And she was also one of those people who were completely at the mercy of her own sense of humour. She could frequently be seen around the playground, clutching somebody's arm to help her stay upright, while she laughed helplessly. Madeline was also fond of Samantha, because during the first week of school, Chloe had fallen passionately in love with Samantha's daughter, Lily, a fellow feisty princess. Madeline's fear that Chloe would befriend Skye had therefore proven unfounded. Thank God. With Abigail's desertion, it would have been just too much to bear right now if Madeline had to then have her ex-husband's kid over for playdates. "Am I the first to arrive?" asked Samantha. "I left home early because I was desperate to get away from my children. I said to Stu, 'I'll leave you to it, mate.'" "You are." Madeline led her into the living room. "Come and have a drink." "Jane is coming, right?" said Samantha. "Yes. Why?" Madeline stopped. "I just wondered if she knew about this petition that's circulating." "What petition?" Madeline's teeth began to grind. Jane had told her about the new accusations being made against Ziggy. Apparently, Amabella refused to confirm or deny that it was Ziggy who'd been hurting her. And according to Jane, Ziggy behaved oddly when she confronted him about it. Jane didn't know if that was evidence of his guilt or something else. Yesterday, she'd been to the doctor to get a referral to a psychologist, which was probably going to cost her the earth. "I just need to be sure," she'd told Madeline. "You know, because of his background." Madeline had wondered if those three girls, Ziggy's half-sisters, were bullies. Then she'd blushed, ashamed of her ill-begotten knowledge. "It's a petition to have Ziggy suspended from the school," said Samantha, with an apologetic grimace, as if she'd stepped on Madeline's toe. "What? That's ridiculous. Renata can't possibly think people would be so small-minded as to sign it." "It wasn't Renata. I think it was Harper who started it," said Samantha. "I think they're quite good friends, right? I'm still getting my head around all the politics of the place." "Harper is very good friends with Renata, as she's quite keen to let you know," said Madeline. "They bonded over their gifted children." She picked up her champagne glass and drained it. "I mean, Amabella seems like a lovely little girl," said Samantha. "I hate to think of her being secretly bullied, but a petition? To get rid of a 5-year-old? It's outrageous." She shook her head. "I suppose I don't know what I'd do if it were Lily in the same situation, but Ziggy seems so adorable with those big green eyes, and Lily says he's always nice to her. He helped her find her favourite marble or something. Are you going to give me a drink?" "Sorry," said Madeline. She poured Samantha a drink. That explains the strange phone call I just got from Thea. She said she was pulling out of the book club. It seemed a bit odd, because she'd been going on about how she wanted to join a book club, how she needed to do something for herself. She was even making some nudge-nudge-wink-wink comments about the raunchy sex scenes in the book, which was, you know, unsettling. But then, just 10 minutes ago, she called and said she had too many commitments.
She has 4 children, you know, said Samantha.
Oh, yes. It's a logistical nightmare, said Madeline. They laughed wickedly together.
I'm thirsting to death, called out Fred from his bedroom.
Daddy will bring you a glass of water, called back Madeline. Samantha's smile disappeared.
You know what Lily said to me today? She said, am I allowed to play with Ziggy? And I said, of course you are. And she said,
Samantha stopped. Her voice changed. Hello, Chloe. Chloe stood at the door, clutching her teddy bear.
I thought you were asleep, said Madeline sternly, even as her heart melted, as it always did at the sight of her children in their pajamas.
Ed was meant to be on kid duty while she hosted the book club. He'd read the book, but he didn't want to join the club. He said the idea of book clubs brought back horrible memories of pretentious classmates in English Lit. If anyone uses the words marvellous imagery or narrative arc, slap them for me, he'd told her.
I was, but Daddy's snoring woke me up, said Chloe.
Due to the recent monster infestation of her room, Chloe had developed a new habit where Mummy or Daddy had to lie down with her just for a few minutes before she fell asleep. The only problem was that Madeline or Ed inevitably fell asleep too, emerging from Chloe's room an hour or so later, dazed and blinking.
Lily's daddy snores too, said Samantha to Chloe. It sounds like a train pulling in.
Were you talking about Ziggy? Said Chloe chattily to Samantha. He was crying today because Oliver's dad said he had to stay far, far away from Ziggy because Ziggy is a bully.
Oh, for God's sake, said Madeline. Oliver's daddy is a bully. You should see him at the PTA meetings.
So I punched Oliver, said Chloe.
What? Said Madeline.
Just a little bit, said Chloe.
She smiled angelically up at them and hugged her teddy.
It didn't hurt him that much.
The doorbell rang at the same time as Fred called out,
Just letting you know, I'm still waiting for my glass of water.
And Samantha grabbed hold of Madeline's arm as she swayed with helpless laughter. Chapter 41. Jane found out about the petition 10 minutes before she was due to leave for Madeline's first book club meeting. She was in the bathroom cleaning her teeth when her mobile rang and Ziggy answered it.
I'll get her, she heard him say.
There was a patter of footsteps and he appeared in the bathroom.
It's my teacher,
he said in an awestruck voice, shoving the phone at her.
Just a sec, mumbled Jane, because her mouth was full of toothpaste and water.
She held her toothbrush aloft, but Ziggy just pushed the phone into her hand and stepped back fast.
Ziggy!
She fumbled with the phone, nearly dropped it, and then held it up high as she gargled, spat, and wiped her mouth.
What now?
Ziggy had been quiet and introspective this afternoon after school, but he'd said that Amabella wasn't even at school today, so it couldn't be that. Oh, God, had he done something to somebody else?
Hi, Miss Barnes. Rebecca, she said to Miss Barnes.
She liked Rebecca Barnes. She knew they were around the same age. There had been much excitement amongst the kids about the fact that Miss Barnes was turning 24. And even though they weren't exactly friends, she sometimes sensed